Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's a bumper edition of the Gegen Pod this week. We've got Mark Schwarzer, Thomas Sorensen and Michael Bridges all jumping into the pod to discuss the big issues of the Premier League weekend and also what happened in the first weekend of La Liga. We've got World Cup watch going on, the Socceroos squad, who's in trouble, who's making a bolt for it. And also 30 years of the Premier League was this week. We talk about how it changed the face of football. I'm your host, Teo Pellizzeri. Let's jump into it. This is the Optus Sport Football Podcast, the Gegen Pod. It is indeed a bumper edition of the Gegen Pod this week. Two weekends of Premier League have been played and La Liga back as well. What a lineup we've got today. Socceroos icon Mark Schwarzer, Premier League legend Thomas Sorensen and former Premier League star Michael Bridges. And Michael Bridges who joins us under a bit of duress today, Bridgie, but thank you for making the special effort to jump in on the Gegen Pod.
Absolute shambles. English, British Rail cancelled. I've had to duck into the nearest hotel just because I didn't want to miss the gig pod. I never would. I've gone out my way. We found a hotel. There's good Wi-Fi and I'm looking forward to chatting all things Premier League and La Liga and a lot of other things regarding debate that we've had on the Premier League 11. So I can't wait to get stuck into that at the end.
Well, let's off the top get into our best and worst moments of the Premier League weekend. Bridgie, hopefully the train cancellations are not your worst moment of the weekend, but what was your best moment of the Premier League this weekend just finished?
I've got to say the best bit for me was the all-in brawl. I loved it when Conte and Tuchel went at it on the sideline. It was the disrespect of one man, not looking at the other manager in the eyes. And I just thought it was fantastic. And I actually loved a bit of the banter from Thomas Tuchel afterwards when he flexed his biceps towards the media when he was in his press conference. I thought that was brilliant. Very passionate and just overboiled. We didn't like the all-in brawl, but I just thought the two of them were fantastic.
Yeah, who said Germans don't have a sense of humour?
Well, you haven't.
Well, we will break that down in a bit more detail as part of today's show. Mark Schwarzer, your best moment of the Premier League weekend?
I think it has to be, for me personally, seeing Nottingham Forest win their first game. I thought that was, considering how many players they've brought in, massive gamble, will it work? Steve Cooper, I think he's done an incredible job. And I'm excited, actually, to see Forest moving forward. I think they'll do pretty well.
And Thomas Sorensen, your best moment?
Yeah, no, I'll take it from that same game. But that was seeing Steve Cooper standing on the pitch before the game. You know, the singing from the stand. And you can just see him soaking it in. You know, and you can just imagine what goes through his head. All the hard work, you know, the history of the City Ground. Yeah, and then as Schwarzer said, them then going on, maybe a little bit luckily, getting the 3 points. But they don't care there. And that home ground is going to be so massive for them.
And whether it was for an individual or a team or a moment, Michael Bridges, what was your worst moment of the second weekend of action?
I have to say Liverpool yet again disappointing and the red card for the headbutt. I thought it was absolutely disgusting. He got wound up from start to finish in the game and he let the occasion get to him. He let everybody around him down with the headbutt. I've seen a great bit of footage. I think Optus put it out when it was the man-on-man marking scenario and he just lost his lid. So I was very disappointed at that. And I actually think the ban will get further. I don't think it'll be three games. He may get five.
Well, we will jump into Darwin Nunez soon. But Schwartzy, your worst moment of the weekend?
Worst moment of the weekend? The ongoing saga of Manchester United. Look, just accept they are middle of the table team. They're not the Man United that everyone thinks they were. They're not anywhere near it. And I have to apologise that none of us mentioned Brentford because their performance was absolutely outstanding as one of the best things of the weekend. I thought they were remarkable. I thought they were brilliant. And so much of it gets lost because everyone talks about how bad Manchester United have been, but Brentford were outstanding from start to finish.
Got it spot on, Swartzy, didn't they? It was really, really embarrassing that first 45 minutes for United. But like you say, I'm pleased you've credited Brentford. I thought they were marvellous. The tactics were spot on.
Yep.
And Thomas, your worst moment of the weekend?
Yeah, no, I'm going to probably get in trouble with the goalkeeping union here. But I think that De Gea first mistake, I think it's crucial in a time now where United need all their top players to stand up. You know, they need to be leaders on the pitch. And De Gea, to be fair to him, he was Players Player of the Year for United last year and had a good season. But I saw him down here in Australia. I think he didn't look sharp in some of the preseason games. And he seems to just taken that into the season. And, you know, United need him, if any, they need him to be solid at the back because we all know the troubles with the back four. So I think that was just a significant, you can just see the air got sucked out of the team exactly at that moment.
Thomas, I don't know, do you think the first mistake is worse than the second? I know it is technically the worst mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
But that happens,
that's
right?
Your job, mate. You've got to save it. You don't pass the butt. You've got to save it.
No. But what I'm saying, is it's a massive mistake, 100%. But he compounds it because he makes the next one, right? So I think he gets away with the one, not two. I think Man United maybe get away with only the one mistake, potentially. Probably not, because Brentford were outstanding. However, I think the fact that it compounds then, he let it affect him, and then he makes another one for the second goal.
Yeah, yeah. You know, again, and I think that's the time that United are in now. You can just see they're shaky, and, you know, there's lack of confidence, and De Gea is a perfect example, I think. Yeah, now there's talk about him playing out from the back. It's never been his strength, but I don't think he's ever been really poor at it. I think it's just obviously been highlighted now. And probably the players in front of him are not, you know, superb on the ball, you know, in Maguire and Lindelof. He didn't play at the weekend, but Martinez did. So, yeah, I agree with you. It was probably both, but he can't have mistakes from him at the back for sure.
But Ten Hag will want to play out the back like he did at Ajax. So the question is that also a mistake from Ten Hag to say, hang on a second, I've got a goalkeeper who's not, one of his strengths is playing out of the back. Look, he's been dropped for Spain because they want to play out at the back. They've got Unai Simon from Bilbao, Sanchez from Brighton is ahead of him. You know, De Gea can't even get in the squad, right? So the problem he's got is that with the ball at his feet is clearly the weakness. And United with Ten Hag want to play out at the back. So now all of a sudden, there's a crisis, right? I don't think Ten Hag has decided overnight that there's a crisis. I think he's had it in the back of his mind for a while that the way he wants to play football, he needs to make that change. But it may come sooner rather than later.
Yeah, potentially.
Let's stick on United as we jump into some of the issues of the week then, because they were always going to come up in our best and worst on the negative side of the ledger. And on the goalkeeping situation, Mark, Thomas, was it a mistake to loan out Dean Henderson given his performance for Nottingham Forest? Do you look at that and say De Gea actually needs the competition and Ten Hag needs that option?
I definitely think he needs competition. You know, there isn't really anyone pushing him like there was last year. And if we do remember, Henderson would have started last season bar COVID and an injury. That just gave De Gea the chance to get in, and fair play, he took it. Like he played really well. But there is a certainly a valid point there. You know, Henderson, we saw him at the weekend. To be fair, it probably couldn't have come at a better time for him and a worse time for United. But, you know, he had a fantastic game. And, you know, they definitely need, now he's gone, they need somebody else, I think, to come in and push De Gea and keep, you know, keep him on his toes or just provide an alternative, maybe playing out from the back, somebody who's got that skill set.
I don't think Henderson could have stayed. I think he was that wound up by last season, and supposedly you saw his interview when he went to Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, yeah,
apparently
yeah.
he was promised. So I don't think there was a possibility of him staying. I think that was already that ship had sailed. I don't think he had to get out of there. That the problem is now bringing someone else in, because Tom Heaton, as good a goalkeeper, I think Tom Heaton's been in the Premier League. He's not the goalkeeper that I would expect Ten Hag would want with someone coming in and being able to play with the ball and play out at the back. So that is a problem. Or look, De Gea doesn't become a bad goalkeeper overnight and makes one mistake or two mistakes in a game, right?
But he does when you're going to be playing out under the new tactics.
Well, that's the problem.
That's the vulnerable side now that Manchester United... Other teams will look at that now and go, we know exactly how to beat Manchester United, press them high, they'll give us the ball.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So then does the manager have to tone it back a little bit and go, look, I haven't got, unless he brings someone in, at the moment, I haven't got someone who can play exactly how I want to play. So I have to tone it down a little bit. And then I have to make sure that that we maybe do a hybrid version of it rather than just go full bang. No, we need to play like I played Ajax. This is the style of football I play. Because at the moment, he hasn't got the right personnel for it.
Ten Hag on the sideline. It did make us laugh when he had his notepad. And I thought he was actually writing out a shopping list because he did not take the pen off the paper. He had that many issues to sort out. He was scratching his head and it was just incredible. The amount of... It was like an essay he had written on that bit of paper. So again, this is just another problem that he's got to try and solve. And he hasn't got much long time in the window.
Maybe the first signing can be a stenographer, Bridgie, so he doesn't get cramps from all the handwriting he's doing. Now, another player that Manchester United have signed but has made an inauspicious start is Lisandro Martinez. Signed from Ajax, so Ten Hag knew all about him. But the big discussion out of the weekend, and particularly the goal that Ben Mee scored, is that he is only 1.75 metres tall. I've met all three of you in person. That's my height. And Fabio Cannavaro was only 1 centimetre taller. So are people too quick to judge Lisandro Martinez, or has the game changed enough since Cannavaro's days, even in 15 years, that 1.75 metres is not tall enough to play centre-back in the Premier League?
I think he is a cracking player. Man United have got a good player. Yes, he did look vulnerable in that one. It was the more the body, the momentum that he actually got done by Ben Mee at the back post. I think it was he just read it a lot better. He's a great player. Height does not matter, especially in these days when Ten Hag and them want to play out. You've got to have all attributes. They'll have a different situation when it comes to aerial battles. You know, they can swap Maguire and he'll always be the guy that drops off and reads the game. He's got to learn to adjust to the Premier League, because there is going to be a lot of physicality about it in certain teams, especially when you're coming up against people like Kiefer Moore at Nottingham Forest and things like that. That's going to be a big one. But that's why the managers get paid the big bucks. Tactically, you've got to come up with solution. But man, just watch that. That will not set him back. He's a very, very good player. And United, I think, have got a diamond.
The only thing I'd say about the comparison with Cannavaro, who was 1 centimetre taller, is he never played in the Premier League, right? So in terms of that physicality, that change of styles. Like, look, imagine, Thomas, you guys at Stoke would have been licking your lips. You'd have been frothing at the mouth coming up against them.
Roy Delap would have been,
God. Kenwyn Jones, bloody Ryan Shawcross, Robert Huth. I mean, the list goes on. Do you know what I'm saying? I know. I agree with you. He's a good player. He's a very good player. But there are certain leagues, certain styles of football, you're going to get battered. It doesn't matter how good you are, how good your timing is. And if Cannavaro was playing against a Stoke or something like that, they would struggle as well.
Take them out for that game and you adjust your style and put some more physical centre-halves in. That's the luxury that not United don't have at this present moment.
The problem. You can go and spend that much money on a centre-half, you've got to play him, right? You've got to believe him and trust him. You've got to play him. And that goes back to, right at the beginning when Ten Hag was given the job, I said, I'm not sure he's the right man to have free reign in bringing in transfers, bringing in these players, because he's never done that before. It was a system at Ajax that they had, and in Ajax, the physicality side of it, it's not so physical as it is in the Premier League.
So, Thomas, you would have been in plenty of dressing rooms where the gaffer would have focused on set pieces extensively over the course of your career.
You focused a whole week on a set piece. That was all we did.
How much actual discussion goes into trying to exploit the weakness of a man-marking situation where you can exploit a difference in height? Is this something that comes up on a weekly basis, or is this specific team-to-team, player-to-player?
Yeah, no, again, I was probably at the extreme at Stoke where that was our,
really?
Little... Oh, yeah, for sure. It comes as a surprise for a lot of people, but that's what we did. I think the game is such small margins now. And I think every team, you got analysts sitting, looking at videos, and you're trying to just gain whatever advantage you can. And this is a perfect thing, like Brentford did with the press. You're looking to gain a little advantage there, set plays for sure. And you do target. Like, you try to isolate weak players, weak links, You try to ultimately get a one-on-one with one of your better players, and already there you got a great chance of a goal, or like we saw. So, and again, it's also for United, they haven't got time for adjustments. We can't sit here and judge Martinez now. You know, we got to give him, you know, 6 months or something, at least. But the problem is the spotlight, it's on United. So, you know, I feel for him really, because he hasn't really got time to adjust, and teams are just going to pile on with set plays and everything else. So, it's a huge part, and why not take advantage?
And Teo, like Thomas has just said there, I thought Brentford's tactics on set plays from corners was magic. They all got together, they bunched up. You didn't know where the players were going to go, but they knew exactly where they were going to be as that ball was delivered. Eriksen marking, I can't think who he was marking again now, who got the header across? It was Tony. And it was a total mismatch, and they worked on it. So again, Brentford, they've worked on that during the week. Not as much as Tommy's teams used to, but they've worked on it. They know their roles and responsibilities, and I thought it was a set play masterclass from them.
But that's where the height comes into it. So when you have a big centre-half, because what happens is you pile in the bodies, you prevent players from having a run-up. It's a slight nudge. Players sometimes are from a standing start trying to flick a ball on. And if you're already a foot shorter than the next person next to you, you've got zero chance of winning a header. And that's part of the other issue that he's going to have. So I think in general play, his timing, that's what Cannavaro was brilliant at, timing and making those adjustments when he needed to. In that physical battle, knew when to dive in, knew not to drop off. He knew when he could have a run-up and win the header. It's not going to happen that easily in the Premier League. It's going to actually be a lot more difficult.
Tommy, yeah. Can I ask you a quick question? Did you actually ever get bored, you and the Stoke players under Pulis? Did you get bored of set players, or did you actually thrive on it and enjoy it?
We were bored out of our skin, mate. Even doing the tactical, we did like a tactical walkthrough every single day, and then the set plays. But we knew it was an advantage, so we knew we had to pay attention. But my God, I think probably about 60-70% of our training was pattern play and set plays every week, every day.
So just to finish on United for now, Erik ten Hag, we've already got a catalogue of photos of him looking like a beaten man and looking like the weight of the world is on his shoulders. It's so early in his tenure for this. When it comes to sort of pointing fingers and apportioning blame, United fans are always quick to go back to the Glazers. Mark Schwarzer, at this stage, are you willing to be patient with Manchester United, or is there a chance that this could spiral and continue to get worse, given that there seems to be a man who's come in, has been given all the responsibility, but how much of this situation is actually of his making?
Well, I don't think you can blame the manager right now. Like, I mean, there is a responsibility, of course, because the players that go on the pitch, that the manager puts them out there, obviously that's his responsibility. There's the reaction, there's the approach to the game that the players put out there. So I mean the manager can only put them out there, can only give them the instructions and select the players. So you could argue and say, well, okay, Martinez was probably the wrong selection. Eriksen playing as a deep holding midfield player was certainly the wrong decision. So there are certainly angles or elements of the game where you have to point your finger at Ten Hag. But then the rest of it, the minute they step over that pitch, you've got to start asking questions of the players, because the players were nowhere near good enough from any position on that pitch. I don't think there's anyone you could say comes off that pitch thinking he's given everything, he's done everything for the team, and he comes away with no charisma whatsoever. But it does definitely... Look, there's an argument to say the owners have spent over £1 billion on players. But it seems headless. It seems lack of direction, lack of organisation. No one really has... They don't seem to buy a Manchester United player anymore. Does anyone even know what a Manchester United player is?
And so that's the problem. Can we just say, though, as a whole and as a collective, you've also got to bring that the coaching staff that are there, the fitness people that are there doing the stuff, because Manchester United were nowhere near as physically adapted and as capable of doing what Brentford did the other day against them. They were miles off the press. And if you're going to play under Ten Hag and you want to have the press, everybody as a collective, it's not just the players, not the Glazers, not the manager, it is that whole club and that whole thing as one at this moment in time. I think everybody is totally below par.
Well, they were working on it straight after the game, weren't they, the next day, on their fitness?
They'd have to.
No, they were supposed to day off, weren't they? They ran like 13Ks on the next day after the game because they obviously clearly didn't run enough and weren't fit enough. But that, look, you you can. Where's the buck stop? So who takes responsibility for the players not being fit enough? It has to be the management, the staff, right? It's the manager. It starts with the manager and the fitness people, right? It has to be with them. You can't turn around to the players unless the players have been negligent, which I don't think they have been. Has he misjudged the pace of the Premier League, the intensity? I don't know. That's just a weird one. I don't get how the players can be that unfit. I don't get it.
I think, you know, again, it's a whole massive issue for the whole club. I think obviously it starts with the Glazers because they have to set the overall strategy, and they are hidden away in America. You know, they're not hands on. So they've last year, you know, they've obviously had Woodward who then went, and now they've got John Murtaugh and Richard Arnold who's in charge of sort of the football technical side, signing players, scouting. And you just lack the strategy. I know they you know, Richard Arnold, when he was, you know, appointed 2 or 3 months ago, I think, you know, came out with massive statements of, you know, what they were going to do. But he's already being questioned now of their transfer window this summer. Like, you're looking 3 players in, haven't really been able to get players out. What is the strategy? Why are they buying players? And for what bigger purpose? And like Mark said, you know, what is the DNA? What are they trying to achieve? What players... it just seems a little bit headless, even though they, you know, they did make changes in that footballing department.
Well, while Manchester United wait for answers and clarity, let's go to Liverpool now. They've drawn 1-1 with Crystal Palace, but the big talking point was the red card for Darwin Nunez. Mark, I've got to start with you because you were so gung-ho on Nunez in pre-season about what a great campaign he was going to have. Do you personally feel let down by his headbutt?
Absolutely.
On Joachim Anderson? And also, take us inside a Premier League dressing room. What happens behind the scenes when a player like Nunez does that?
I wouldn't be surprised if Jurgen Klopp was doing his absolute nut in the change room, because it cost them, and it's just silly. And I mean, I heard a comment today from Jurgen Klopp saying he was provoked a little bit, right? But come on, there was no provoking in that instance. To do what he did was just ridiculous.
I provoke you every Gegenpod episode, but you've never, ever headbutted me.
Yeah, but that's only because you're not in the room.
He would have.
If you were in the room with me, I would have headbutted you by now. And it would have been a flying one as well. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, it's a bit... It's just one of those things that's unacceptable. And look, I think just because he's done that and he's been silly and he's been a rush of blood, whatever it is, got caught up in the moment, it doesn't make him a bad player, and he's gonna pay for it, and Liverpool are gonna pay for it in terms of not having him available. And I think he's gonna be a big miss for them because every game he's had involvement in, come on, he's made a difference, he's changed the game. And last night, unfortunately, in my opinion, he's cost them the 3 points, because had he been on that football pitch, I think they would have won the game.
I've got to say, this did actually happen to me. It's my only red card in my career. It was for the reserves, for Hull City playing against Rotherham. And I'm not proud of it, but I coming back from an Achilles operation, and it still wasn't, you know, I could still feel it. And the young player that was marking me, obviously he'd been told by the manager just to wind us up. He's an old pro trying to get himself back again. He's had a bit of injuries, just wind him up. And he just kept putting his studs down the back of my Achilles and just like trying to scrape it away from the ball. And I just turned around and I just put the headbutt on this young lad and regretted it instantly. But at the moment in time, the heat of the moment, I'd already warned him and it carried on. And it's not something I'm proud of. But straight away inside the dressing room after the game, I knew I was about to get absolutely destroyed by the manager. And I just said, I hold my hands up. I'm totally taking accountability and responsibility for this. And the first thing I did, I made sure that after the game, I went into the dressing room and waited for that player to come out and apologise.
And gave another one.
And I think,
apologise.
And then he gave me one back. but no, I think it depends how he's handled that in the Liverpool dressing room. If he's owned up and he said, I'm sorry, lads. And if he hasn't and he's blamed Anderson for the tactics that he used against him, then he's only got himself to blame and deserves everything that's coming his way from Klopp and the team.
Yeah, and as a young player, you don't want that, you know, tendency to be hanging over. You know, he needs to learn from it quickly, move on. I don't think there'll be anything done other than he'll get a bollocking and potentially a fine. But if you start to see him struggle with players being up his back, then again, like we talked about with Manchester United, other teams are going to target it. You know, there are players that are they are experts in mind games, experts in just getting under your skin, and you can't show that
weakness.
What's
every centre half now going to do to him?
Yeah, that's for sure. Again, he's a young player. Like, we got to give him some, you know, a little bit of space to just learn from his mistake.
Yeah, look, there's no hiding from it. He would have looked at it on the and just gone and walked in. I'm sure when he walked in there, I'm sure he's held his hands up and said, "Like, you know, it's madness. Sorry, I've let everyone down." And that's the way as they move on.
And as a Dane, I'm not too happy with the acting and the fall of Joachim Andersen. go online and have a look at how he falls off when he gets notched. it's not a proud moment for us, Dane.
Tell you what, mind Thomas, he was lucky that the back. He tried to back headbutt him just before moments before that, and he was lucky he didn't catch him with that one. And that's what Andersen was annoyed at. And
I haven't got that big a problem with him carrying on. Like I don't actually have that big a dish because he did get him, and maybe if he doesn't dive backwards and fall backwards, maybe it could have been worse, right? Because you know, if you're trying to stand up against it, I don't have a problem with it. If the player if the opposition player is that silly, naive to do what he's done, you get what you deserve in the end. Doesn't matter if someone's made the meal of it or not.
So it's taken less than a handful of games, Mark, though. Do you think that Nunez is now going to be the target of the wind-up merchants and a bit of niggling to try and get this done on a weekly basis? Or do you think he has the discipline to behave in a way that by the midpoint of the season, defenders will have learnt that he's not gettable in a similar fashion every single week?
Look, I think part of his game is to be physical and be in people's faces and have that physical contact. And I think he thrives off it by the looks of it, you know, what I've seen so far of him and what we saw him in the Champions League. Look, he knows he's not naive. He's played enough football to know that people are going to target him. He's going to have to stay strong. He's going to have to keep his temper under control. He's going to have to make sure he keeps his cool. And I'm sure Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp will be saying the same thing to him. I've got no doubt he will learn from it. There's no doubt for me. And especially under Jurgen Klopp, I just don't think it'll happen. It's not going to be like it's happened in the past with players like Suarez has gone and bitten three people at different clubs, or twice at Liverpool, I think, wasn't it? I know, once at Liverpool, once at Uruguay, So I just don't think that's going to be an ongoing thing.
No, and they got the culture. They got the culture there. You know, I agree. That's the thing. Like, had it happened at Man United, you would probably potentially see a bigger problem because they don't seem to have that at the moment.
They'd all be getting headbutts to get sent off because they don't want to play.
Let's move on to the other major flashpoint of the week. This is going to be a meme for years to come, if not forever. The Conte-Tuchel handshake. It's taken away from what was a sensational game as well. Late stoppage time equaliser for Tottenham for a 2-2 draw between Spurs and Chelsea. But that moment, how did it leave you feeling? It was just the supercharged energy that sparked an all-in brawl. And you know the season means the world to these clubs when you get that in just the second week of the campaign. Mark, how did it leave you feeling?
How did it leave me feeling? I mean, I was obviously slightly gutted for Chelsea because I felt that probably the goal shouldn't have stood. You know, I think there was definitely a foul in the box on Cucurella. Should have been, and there was a foul before that. I think it was on Kai Havertz that should have been given. But, you know, it is what it is. But got to give Tottenham credit. Never giving up, never saying you know, that it's over with, they can't win the game, and they kept going, even though all the stats said otherwise, that Chelsea should have won the game comfortably. So it's fun for me, for Chelsea, that got away. But what a game to watch, you know, entertainment from start to finish, on and off the pitch. And it kind of rolled back the years, didn't it, of football and what we used to have in the Premier League probably much every week. And yeah, it was exciting. And I think I expected something to happen because every time that Chelsea plays against Tottenham and vice versa, there's always something that we all talk about.
In a good old Kevin Keegan fashion, I absolutely loved it. That spat on the sideline. I think, you know, again, we want to see passion. Like we sit here and we criticize people for not, you know, being invested. And, you know, and here you got two managers. They think that they took it right to the line. I don't think they overstepped the line. You know, if it happened every week, we would probably have a problem. But I'm okay with it that it happens once in a while. I think it's a great entertainment, and it also shows how much is at stake and how much it means to to these managers, these clubs, and also the pressure they're on. You know, I think, you know, Tottenham, you know, there's pressure, Tuchel with everything that's gone on there. So, you know, that's just the game we are. But for us sort of neutrals, I know Sportsy is not quite neutral. He was nearly crying there with that late equaliser. But, you know, it's great for everyone else.
We were robbed. We were robbed. But Bridgie, you have to agree, right? It shouldn't have been a goal, right? There should have been a foul on Kai Havertz, and how Romeo didn't get done for Cucurella's thing. And they even looked at it afterwards, and apparently there's nothing in the rule book about grabbing someone's hair, which I
honestly,
I've never heard anything like it.
No hair. You support Chelsea, so you don't care, and you come up with more excuses than Jurgen Klopp does.
Do you think that was all right?
I don't know what you're on about, mate. Sorry, I'm breaking up. Sorry.
All right, Mr. Wenger, you never saw it, did you?
So the aftermatch scene with so many people coming in to try and break up this confrontation, do you have any recollections of all-in brawls that you've been involved in your career, whether you were a bystander or you were a peacemaker or whether you were part of the action? Feel free to jump in. Has anyone actually been in the thick of a similar situation?
I had a quick one in Derby in a hotel with Lee Bowyer over a spaghetti bolognese where me and him were fighting over a bit of pasta. Can you believe Lee Bowyer had a short fuse? His nickname was the Firework. Thankfully, it was it was enclosed. It was only for the players getting their buffet, and the all-in brawl happened because the lads were all trying to separate us. But me and Lee laughed at each other when we had spaghetti bolognese all over our tracksuits and just said, what the hell was all that about? So that's the only one I've ever been involved in.
Yeah, no, I had one with a Danish national team and Thomas Gravesen. We were playing Malta, and at halfway line, there was a bit of a scuffle. Gravesen and Mifsud, all their players piled in. I ran for my goal, and we ended up, for I think 5 minutes trying to separate everyone. And I didn't quite know what was going on, but then the day after, I think you can go on the internet and just type in Gravesen and Mifsud. He's got both his hands. He's strangling Mifsud, and how he didn't get sent off. So I totally get why their players reacted and why it became a brawl. But Gravesen, he was an absolute lunatic, and that is one of the funniest, but still, you know, quite serious pictures I've ever seen in football. And again, why he didn't get sent off is still a bit in disbelief over it.
I've had a few, not personally. But I've had a few where I've been at the club when they've happened. One of them was at Middlesbrough. Actually, two were at Middlesbrough. One was with Chris Riggott and Mark Viduka. And it was literally, we're playing a small-sided game and on a really small, like an 18-yard box. And it was them two at each other, like wrestling almost. And it just got to the point where Dukes had enough. Riggs, I think Duke said to him, next time you do it, I'm gonna give you one, whatever. And it was like really close combat. And then as it happened, they both fell into a tangle and they were wrestling on the ground. And luckily, because they're both massive, right? And luckily, they couldn't swing because everyone piled in on top and prevented anything from happening. And then afterwards, they were all laughing and having a joke about it. The other one was George Boateng and the late Hugo Ekiog. The nice guys sitting to it, chatting to each other, and it got a bit heated, and I think Hugo was giving him a little bit, was pressing the wrong buttons, and George literally stood up, and it was two tables pushed against each other. He dived across the table and threw himself at Hugo Ekiog, and they was like, they were a tangle in the bistro upstairs, and like the big physio masseuse guy came over. He was huge, he used to be a weightlifter, came over, and a whole lot of us are in there trying to pull him apart, and it was just like mayhem. And the other one was at Fulham, Johnny Pansel and Olivier Decor. It was hilarious. Well, kind of. So they were at each other from day one, and I don't know quite why. Maybe because Olivier Decor the whole time kept talking about what he'd won and how well he was doing and what a big career he had and what he had. Because he came to us and it was right at the end, he was struggling. He was nowhere near the same player as he was when he was at Leeds United. And then we were doing the first 11 shape. And Johnny Pansel went off the pitch as Roy Hodgson sent in the first 11. He turned around, there was a ball near the corner flag, turned around and went, watch this. And he pinged it about 45 yards and it hit Olivier Decourt in the back. And then Johnny Pansel just turned and walked off. But everyone was just like, oh my God. And he knew it was him. He just knew it. So he followed him into the change room. And as he came into the change room, it just basically launched himself at him, and they like punch and throw and like windmills at each other and carrying on. So we piled in, we managed to stop them, and we thought, right, that's okay. Johnny Pants will get all his gear off, put his towel on and goes to the shower. And then we thought, oh, that's all settled. And then all of a sudden, Olivier de Court has just got his towel and runs off into the shower. And we thought, hang on, shit, they're both going to the shower. As we get in there, they're wrestling naked in the shower, throwing punches at each other. And then, honestly, we walk in there because we hear all this noise, and there's like a couple of us going to the shower, and we hear it all kicking off, and then we start running. So there's literally about five of us in there end up being naked trying to break it all up. Honestly, what a imagine a fly on the wall or a hidden camera, what that would look like.
Incredible. Some amazing and certainly unique types of brawls that have happened in the careers of our Gegenpod experts. Incredible. That wraps us on the Premier League just for now, but let's take a look at La Liga, which of course had all games live and exclusive on Optus Sport over the weekend. Just quickly round the table, what caught your eye from the results and the action from La Liga over the course of the weekend? Thomas, I'll start with you.
You know, I think Swartzy was watching it firsthand. And again, great job for Optus Sport covering it. Ava Mabil, obviously having an Aussie in La Liga, him coming on at halftime. And I think showing some good skills. I think he'll fit that league extremely well. And, I think that's what Australian football needs. I think you need players to play on a big stage, and he'll become a much improved player, I think, if he can get regular game time there.
I'm going to jump in here on this one off the back of that, Tommy. I totally agree with Swarty. Got to interview him as well, which was great to see. But I've got to point out Barcelona, because I thought they, yet again, looked absolutely abysmal. And you think of the money that was spent and what's been going on, the players they've been trying to sign, and they could not find the back of the net yet again. So for me, I thought that was, it's the same old story. And I'm hoping they do get out of this glitch and they do get back on the score sheet, because the team and the players that they've signed is very, very exciting. But it's the same story. They could not find the back of the net. And it didn't look good, especially when Madrid won their first game as well, comfortably.
What, comfortably?
Well, not comfortably, but nice. Madrid, we got 3 points, Tommy.
Well, yeah, they're okay. Not comfortably. No, they were lucky. Yeah, they need David Alaba to come on and like hit a freakish free kick with his only first touch of the ball. I there's a few things. Obviously, I was in Cardiff to watch Cardiff against Real Sociedad. I have to say, Aubameyang was unbelievable in terms of, I met him 2 days beforehand. He's a great, great person. He's a great human being. He's a fantastic ambassador for the Socceroos, Australian football. I have to say, I cannot speak highly enough about the guy. He was brilliant. Gave us all the time in the world. And again, like Tommy was saying there, I thought he was excellent when he came on at halftime. He made a big difference to their team. Surprised he didn't start, certainly seeing their team. But you knew about 10 minutes into the game that he was coming on, because he started warming up. And he warmed up for literally I would say, 35 minutes of that first half. And then he was at halftime, he was doing some more work, and then he came straight on and he made a massive difference. And the league, yeah, the team, the club, it's a great part of the world, and he's going to settle in really, really well. And I think he's going to be a big player for them. The other side is, I think there's a karma out there. I think there is someone up there looking out, because what Barcelona are doing, in my opinion, is a disgrace. Allowed to sign players, do what they're doing. They're talking about cancelling players' contracts. Braithwaite, because he won't leave, they're talking about cancelling his contract. What they're doing with De Jong is disgraceful. And I just don't understand. Yeah, they can't, and they shouldn't be, but they are at the moment. And I think it's so appalling for football, and they're just turning more and more people against them.
Yeah, and there's still talks of Bernardo Silva coming in. So we'll see what happens there.
How can you not pay players? Players have outstanding money that's owed to them, but you've freed up all this money to spend 150 million, whatever it is, on new players. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It actually makes a mockery of financial fair play. It makes a mockery of everything that goes in football about trying to make sure that there's an even playing field. But obviously some people don't think there is.
Or shouldn't be. Regardless of what's going on off the field, on the field, they had some real issues with Rayo Vallecano. Barcelona had a ton of chances, had two disallowed goals. Obviously, the game ended in a nil-all draw. But not registering Jules Koundé, was that automatically a mistake, given that Andreas Christensen looked particularly shaky and his defending actually led to one of Vallecano's best chances to score?
Christensen. I thought he had a great game.
Oh, Danish friend. Hello.
Oh, yes, I was just waiting for that, Bridgie. I'm a big fan of Christensen. Yes, he didn't have a perfect game, but on the other hand, I didn't think he was that shaky. I think they had other issues. I think Rayo Vallecano did really well. I think they pressed high. They made it really tough for Barcelona to play out to get the ball forward. And I still think they got to find a way, a little bit like Manchester City. They got to find a way to play Lewandowski. He's different from what they've had at least the last couple of years, and that's going to take a bit of time. And let's be honest, Lewandowski should have scored at least one in that game. So it could have been a different story, I think, all around. But a clean sheet, I think that's okay. I think I'm not gonna ask Christensen for that.
All right, that is La Liga, which continues this weekend on Optus Sport, of course. We're going to take a quick break here on the Gegenpod. It's the Optus Sport Football Podcast, back with some of the issues closer to home right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Gegenpod, the Optus Sport football podcast. We've got Mark Schwarzer, Thomas Sorensen and Michael Bridges in the pod today, and we are going to turn our focus to a bit of World Cup watch. Mark Schwarzer, as we heard in the previous segment, met Awamabil over in Cadiz, and as the countdown continues, let's just take a quick look at the state of the Socceroos squad, especially with so many Australians currently playing in Scotland and playing in European leagues. Mark, we'll start with you. Has anyone put their name on the radar as a bit of a left field pick or a bolter at the moment? Do you think Graham Arnold's squad stability will hold? Is there anyone you think should be worried about their place in the team at the moment as we get closer to the New Zealand friendlies, which of course will be our last matches in the Southern Hemisphere before the team heads to Qatar?
I think anyone who's not playing regular football has to have some concerns, because leading up to a World Cup, I think it's always so important to play week in, week out. Look, I think we look at Matty Ryan, big reason why he left Real Sociedad, to go and find regular football. They're playing as we speak, and he's playing in the Champions League for Copenhagen. So that automatically is paying dividends, that he's had an opportunity to go to a club and a big club, certainly in Denmark, and he's gonna play regular football week in, week out. I think Scotland's an interesting one when you look at the number of Aussie players up there, and key for us is how many of the guys are playing week in, week out. One player I'd like to see given an opportunity, certainly against New Zealand maybe, is Cammy Devlin. I think he needs to be in and around that World Cup squad. I think he needs to be at the very least getting an opportunity within the national team to see firsthand, close up, how he's doing, how he fits in, and how much he's improved since coming across to Scotland.
Any news on Riley McGree at Middlesbrough from your contacts?
No, nothing at the moment, mate. I haven't heard anything, no.
I'm a big admirer of his. I'd love to see him get some opportunity and capitalise on stuff.
Well, I mean, the thing is, he's obviously there or thereabouts and regularly in the squad, right? The question is, obviously, Graham Arnold hasn't, up until now, seen him as a regular. He's seen him as a bit part player. I think Aaron Moy was key. I thought Aaron Moy was probably arguably some of his best football. He's played in a long, long time in those World Cup qualifiers. And the incredible that he actually lasted the extra time with the game against Peru, and considering he hadn't played hardly any football for 6 months. So now the key will be for him, off the back of hopefully playing a lot of football at Celtic. And so long as he stays fit, he's massive for us. Ryan McGree, look, they're all going to play a part, I think. I think they're all going to be important players moving forward. I agree with you. I thought he was excellent, Ryan McGree, last season, back end of last season. And he's someone, again, that will, I would think, be pushing for a starting spot in the team.
Well, Teo, the voice of the A-League, give us your opinion.
No, I was going to ask Thomas about matters here at home, because some of the players, like, on the outer fringes of Graham Arnold's squad, say Lockie Wales, Western United, get rolled in the Australia Cup by Sydney United. They're out. They don't play a competitive game now for another 6-7 weeks until the start of the A-League. How important is it for Marco Tilio that Melbourne City actually keep winning in the Australia Cup? Because, again, they could be in a situation where if they get rolled by Wellington tonight, they won't play a competitive game for 6 or 7 weeks.
Yeah, I'll be at that game. So, so it'll be interesting to see. And you know, he's one of them that's on the fringes. And I think most of the attacking players, you've got Jamie McLaren as well. You know, they've only got a short window to prove their form. You know, so it's definitely a huge advantage if you are playing in Europe and as Schwartz said, week in and week out. So I think it doesn't help with the A-League starting that late. I think it's only a month before the World Cup, more or less, and that's not ideal. And as you said, you know, he's one of them. You know, I thought he dropped off a little bit last season. I thought he had that breakthrough. I thought he was electric, and then, you know, going into the finals, I thought he lost his way a little bit. So I'll be interested, seeing tonight what he can actually offer. Is he back to his best? Because he needs to be if he wants to be in that Socceroos squad.
The other player that seems to be in a bit of trouble at the moment is Aidan Rustic. He's been exiled from the Eintracht Frankfurt side. There's been reports in Spain about him potentially going to Real Betis, which would be brilliant because we'd see him on Optusport every week. And Betis is obviously a great... Real Betis is a really good club in Seville. And there's also talk, potentially, if that doesn't happen, that he could end up in Serie A with Salernitana. Lantana, is it right?
How we Salernitana, yeah. But the Betis room is very tempting, Schwartz, because he'd be playing for Manuel Pellegrini. Betis had a 3-0 win against Elche at the weekend. They have huge crowds, fanatical following. That'd be a great landing spot for Rustic if he goes there.
That'd be huge. And it'd be fantastic. It really would be. I mean, I think technically that side of things will suit him well because he's that technically gifted player. And I think that he would come on in leaps and bounds if that were to happen.
But Schwartz, where does he get more game time? Going to a team that's struggling in Serie A, just survived, or trying Real Betis where you might be restricted to game time in a time where you need to play?
Yeah, that's the key, isn't it? I mean, look, I think being part of the Eintracht Frankfurt squad that won the Europa League last season, he's shown that he's got quality enough to play in a top league. There's always a balance, isn't there? There's always a balance of going, okay, do I go with a lesser team, potentially where I'm going to play more often week in, week out, but you'll be fighting for survival every week, and it may be hiding to nothing. I'm not really sure how they sit in Serie A and what their chances are of staying and what their type of team is, but I know at Real Betis, I think he'll certainly be a more stable club and an opportunity, I think, to improve as a player far more by going there.
Let's now turn to Tom Rogic. There have been any number of rumours, whether it was Middle East, an A-League return, Cyprus even come up. Now we have rumours of retirement. Schwartzy, does Tom Rogic owe anyone an explanation? I mean, given that it's such a sensitive matter that literally no one seemingly outside of his most inner circle of confidants actually knows what's going on, are we owed an explanation, or is it actually time to stop asking questions and wait until he's ready to come forward and tell us why there's been such a shroud of mystery over the situation?
Well, I think it is strange. I think a lot of people would have expected Tommy Rogic to be somewhere by now. Does he need to come out and explain himself? No. You know, it's up to him to decide when and where he'll want to play, if at all, and whether or not he wants to stay on and keep playing football. I mean, look, I think it would be a great shame if he were to retire. I can't believe for a moment that's necessary. I would think it's less likely to happen. So I'd like to see him still play and hopefully play at the highest possible level.
Well, if he is looking for a job after retirement, he can get a job doing the British Rail train drivers, because there's none of them around at this moment in time. They've been missing in action just like him.
It is a tough one because it sometimes, you know, the longer it goes without even the slightest source of information as to why his sabbatical from football has taken place, it almost feels like we're starting to infringe on something that could be far more serious. So, Thomas, at what point do we have to stop pining for the return of Tom Rogic and maybe make peace with the fact that he's not going to be part of the World Cup squad for Australia?
Yeah, no, I think it's just a sad situation because obviously hugely important player, one of the Socceroos' best players. I think everyone knows what he can offer. I thought he played well in the games, you know, leading up to him not coming in for the squad. You know, it's just a tough situation because, you know, it's not like you got a heap of talent. And I think that's where, you know, the questions, you know, will you know, especially from the press and from everyone who's interested, will keep being there. And I experienced with, you know, a similar situation we had with Denmark, where we 2 games into a World Cup qualification, Thomas Gravesen suddenly decided he didn't want to play anymore. And he never answered any questions. He never said anything. None of us players knew what was going on. And he went to Celtic. The press, you know, was after him, but he stood his ground. I don't think he's ever given an explanation. And, you know, that's just, you know, obviously the right you have as a player, but it's frustrating for everyone else and definitely for the Socceroos.
Tay, I think you were hitting it. We don't know what kind of mental state he is in at this present time. He could have had things going off the field with family. He could have things going on mentally, or he could just be waiting for the right opportunity to get the contract. So we've got to give him the honour and give him the privilege because of what he has done in the game for club and for country, and just hope that he makes the right decision and it is within the next couple of months. And if not, we've got to respect his decision and just admire everything that he was about.
Well, sticking on matters of Australian football, Ernie Merrick, who just about everyone in the game knows at some level or another, the long, long time coach at a number of levels of the game, has taken over the role as the new Chief Football Officer of Australia, a role that had been advertised since March. It's now been filled in August. Rather than talk about the Merrick appointment, though, because we've known about it for a couple of weeks, I want to flip the tables and ask, what is the first thing you would start working on if you were handed the remit to fix Australian football as the wide-ranging powers of the Chief Football Officer allows you to do? Mark, what would be the first thing that you start asking questions about and start working on your first day in the chair?
Oh, my God. How much time we got?
Sporty, make it quick, please, mate, will you?
Yeah, I mean, look... I think for me, one of the biggest problems is I've said it many times before, I don't think as a nation, as a football nation, we're unified enough. I don't think the federations across the country work together. I don't think they care necessarily about anything else other than outside their own state. And that's probably the biggest demoralizing thing for me, is that you just think, look, everywhere else, certainly in Europe, the league, the federation has the ultimate say in the control and the direction. And whether you believe it's the right direction or not, everyone's following a certain pathway. And the states, counties, whatever it is, they have such a minimal say. And they're there to implement it and they all work together. But unfortunately, we don't have that in Australia. That's probably, for me, one of the biggest hurdles. I think you can come up with all the ideas in the world, but if you don't have people working together, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, Swartzy. I think that's the first, should be top of the agenda. You know, try to unify, you know, there's too many people working in different directions. And also not being the number one sport. I think, you know, football, if you really want to change things and you want to make football, which I think in time will be the biggest sport and most popular sport in Australia, you know, everyone has to be on the same page. I think, you know, that's where you can fight some of the political issues, and, you know, you can fight the AFL, you can fight all the other things that are working against football at the moment, and then you can start building a structure that's sound and a proper pathway for young players. But you're seeing local teams working, you know, they're not looking beyond their own tip of the nose. You know, they're just thinking about himself.
Tommy, that will never happen.
financially, the A-League and the governing bodies in football, soccerous across the board, have got nowhere near the financial clout that the AFL teams and the memberships have. They've got the support of the media as well. It's the national, you know, the national sport then. You can't change culture that quickly.
It's not an overnight thing, I'm sure.
No. And I agree with the Federation things, how everybody is after a piece of their own pie. And it's, I think somebody nailed it. They said it's not the ecosystem, it's the ego system in Australia with the football pyramid. Everybody's in it for a piece of their own mind. But for me, if you're talking about football and the time management that goes into it, Tio, you've just mentioned if you get knocked out of the cup to Thomas, you've got like how many weeks or months off before your next game?
That 6 to 7 weeks, yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't happen around some of the big leagues around the world. We need more game time. We need more teams involved. And you need players and across the board to be playing and getting numbers in minutes under their belt. Because if you do the maths, it's a maths game. The longer you train, the longer you play, the better you become. And there's not enough games and there's not enough teams at the highest level in this country as yet. And there's not one quick fix. There's a lot of fixes need to be done. And Ernie hopefully has got some ideas that he can try and implicate. I think he's on a losing battle because many people have come before him, many have tried, and many have failed, sadly.
Yeah, but that's not a reason why you don't try, right? That's why we don't give up. No. But going back to what you were saying about AFL and about being the number one sport and everything else, one of the reasons why we'll never be the number one sport is if we don't work together. And if all the federations, yeah. You talk about AFL, cricket, rugby league, all of the federations, all of their various states all work together. AFL control everything. There's a headquarters and they control everything across the whole of the country. We just don't have that. We are completely divided. Individual state federations are very, very wealthy, far wealthier than the Football Federation. But unfortunately, it just stays within and it doesn't get... It's not about the good of the game overall. It's about the good of the game within their own little territories. And that's unfortunately the most what people are worried about. So that whole pyramid thing of getting more teams in the top flight and all of that, that only works, in my opinion, over the course of the long run, which we've already seen with the A-League, teams coming and going, falling apart, teams struggling to stay afloat, is if everyone is together and everyone's working together. We don't have that.
Well, if you are listening to the Gegen Pod and you like this sort of topic, you want us to maybe have a breakout show on this issue alone to give it the time it deserves, let us know on socials, let us know in the comments, give us the feedback, and if there's a groundswell for it, we will make it happen. We might make it happen regardless because it's a very interesting topic. Now, a slight tangent to this, 30 years of the Premier League is being celebrated this week. All the content on Optus Sport has the new logo for PL30. There's been lots of trips down memory lane, and that's what we did last week here on the Gegen Pod as well, talking about some of our best players and favourite games and biggest moments of the 30 years of the Premier League era. But here's the question I've got for you today. What can other leagues around the world learn from the Premier League and how it has evolved over the three decades in which it has absolutely changed the face of football? And I think the fact that La Liga has ended up on Optus Sport and there's been such a dedicated push into Australia to accompany the rights moving to Optus Sport is reflective of the impact the Premier League has had, that La Liga has made such a concerted effort to expand into new territories and to market itself to the Australian audience. So that's probably the thing that I would say other leagues are learning from the Premier League, that global footprint. But Bridgie, what do you think that other leagues can learn from the 30 years of Premier League?
The marketing, the advertising, the promotion of the game, making it exciting across the board for a wide range. And they actually worked out how do we keep the ball in players. You know, the multi-ball system came in. They changed the rules from certain things as well just to make the action as good as possible. But I just think it's all about the advertisement, the hype, the build-up, and the players that are brought into the league on a regular basis each season that keeps everybody so excited. And, you know, it's such a shame sometimes when you're living in Australia and you're actually scratching your head to look for when the A-League is actually starting over there. And people are coming at me saying, do you know anything about when the leagues are, when's it kicking off, what's going on? Yeah, we don't advertise it enough, we don't sponsor it and promote it enough over in Australia. Now, how that happens, Teo, I don't know what the rules and regulations are, but the Premier League absolutely nail it, and it does help when you're getting the TV money and the rights that we do for the Premier League. And, you know, just to be part of it with Optus Sport has been sensational. Long may it continue. And, yeah, a lot of leagues can learn from it, and some of the ones that do, they're picking up off the back of that, definitely, like you say, with La Liga and Serie A.
Thomas, what can other leagues around the world learn from 30 years of the Premier League?
I think the business model, obviously, you know, the way Football League in the past, when they distributed all their money to all their clubs, I think the Premier League, you know, the flagship, you know, that's what's going to attract your fans, your attention. And I think, you know, establishing the Premier League as just being the top tier and then focusing on that, you know, getting the most out of it, distributing the way they distribute your money, because you got to stay competitive. That's the fun about football, is that a Leicester can go and win the Premier League. You know, where you look at Spain, the way they distribute the money, yes, they are making changes, but you're looking at most of the money going to two teams. I think, you know, you're trying to do something similar in Australia, use the similar business model now with, you know, with the Australian Premier Leagues, the setup there, you know. So we're trying to learn something here in Australia, but the Premier League is the pinnacle. What they did, you know, 30 years ago, I think was unique. And they're still, as Bridgie said, they're looking for innovation all the time. They're looking for new avenues of sponsorship, of revenue, and it's cutting edge, and that's why they're the best.
I think you nailed on the nail on the head there, Thomas. Distribution of wealth. I think right from the off, the Premier League have been very, very good at being fair in their distribution. Not one club gets necessarily any more money than the other, and it's based on league positions, the competitiveness of the league. And I also think what was important, I think the Premier League, when it first started off, was quite humble and quite in a position where they knew they had to draw more people. They had to impress people. They wanted a bigger audience. They wanted people to like the game. They needed to convince people that it was a game to watch. Hooliganism was a thing of the past, that football was in a new era. That marketing was sensational. I think a lot of the other leagues, I think, have played on the idea that they've been regarded like Serie A was the best in the 90s, and you know, La Liga's had Real Madrid and Barcelona, and I think they've just relied on those clubs, and those clubs are the only ones that have been the dominant force and had all the attention, and they're happy for that to long, you know, to continue for a long time. Look at Germany, Bayern Munich dominating the Bundesliga. The more competitive leagues become, look, Serie A has become more interesting now because the dominance of Juventus has been broken. And there's other teams, AC Milan come from nowhere of 10 years of the sleeping giant of coming and winning the title. People are actually more interested now. Of course, you've got the diehard Italians who want to watch Serie A. But I think overall, I'm actually more interested in Serie A now. I think a lot more people are more interested in it. La Liga is slightly more interesting up until the point now where Barcelona has been able to do what they want to do. And that's part of the issue, I think, with La Liga, is that it becomes so dominated by only a handful of teams and the rest of the rest. And that's what I think people are a little bit like, well, it's the same old same. It's great if you're a supporter of that team, but even that, I think over a period of time, gets a bit boring.
Some great insights there into what other leagues can learn from 30 years of the Premier League. And don't forget, some of the featured content on Optus Sport this week includes big manager blow-ups in homage to Conte and Tuchel. Mark Schwarzer, you've got a piece coming up with Brian Dean. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's talking about almost like 30, well, it has been 30 years to the day when he scored the very first goal in the Premier League. And I know Brian pretty well from my time playing with him at Middlesbrough. Another very humble guy, really, really down-to-earth guy. And he talks about that day. We go to Bremer Lane. We go through. We talk through the goal. We talk about how the game started, what the feeling was around as a player back in that day of the Premier League, the beginning of it. And he goes on to talk about, you know, everybody got new kits. It was a complete fresh launch. Every club had a new design of a shirt, and that was kind of the beginning of, and they even, you know, he joked about it and said, we even had cheerleaders at football matches. You know, it was just, he could feel that it was different. And the moment, you know, scoring, I think it was in within 4 minutes against Manchester United. You know, they beat Manchester United 2-1, and Brian actually scored both goals on that day. They still have the goals at Bramall Lane of that day.
And also the ball is in a museum somewhere in Sheffield as well. So, you know, it played a big part in his life, and it's there forever. And no one will ever take that away from him, that he was the first ever goal scorer in the Premier League.
I think that's another thing when we talk about what the Premier League has done well. It really treasures its history, even though it is relatively young, 30 years. It does such a good job of mythologizing those stories, and the fact that you're speaking and interviewing Brian Dean and seeing the goals and the ball and standing on the scene that it happened. It's so great at just perpetuating the sort of the gravitas of what has been achieved in the Premier League. So I think, in a sense, Schwartzy, you've nailed it right on the head there. And well, I think anyone who hasn't seen it yet on the Optus Sport app or website, make sure you get on and watch it. All right, we've left this until last because pre-show, our preparation chat was popping off here in a debate. Now, I have to get on a plane in just under 2 hours, fellas. So let's...
Oh, yeah, plenty of time then.
Let's not get carried away with this. But we wanted to follow in the footsteps of Michael Owen and Ian Wright, who named their all-time Premier League 11. We are working towards a combined Gegenpod 11, best of the Premier League era. Now, from your initial selections, here are the players that came in unanimous. If you want to wind any of these back, you can, but let me run through them first. We were unanimous on, and this is Schwarzer, Bridges and Sorensen's picks. I didn't have a say, I just aggregated it. Schmeichel in goal, Gary Neville at right back, Ashley Cole at left back, Kevin De Bruyne and Patrick Vieira as two of a midfield three, Alan Shearer and Thierry Henry as two of a front three. The remaining debates were over centre-backs, the third midfielder, and another of the three attackers. Let's start at the centre of defence then. We had Tony Adams get two nominations, Rio Ferdinand get two nominations, and John Terry get two nominations. Having had an hour and a bit to think about it, do we have any consensus now on who we want as our centre-backs in the Premier League 30 years best team?
First of all, it's a very positive issue to have. Like, they're all three great defenders, but you know, my point of view is you know, looking at stats, looking at the importance. I think Schwartz a little bit threw me a curveball, but I think John Terry needs to be in there, and then I'm just a fan of the old guard. I think Tony Adams, what he did for Arsenal, you know, England. For me, he just pips it across from Ferdinand, but you know, it's tight margins. But that would be my selection.
All right, I'm going to run this like an auctioneer. Adams and Ferdinand going once. Anyone want to nominate John Terry, Nemanja Vidic? Going twice. Sold. All right, those are our centre backs. Thank you, Tommy. Bridgie, we had Scholes and Lampard as a bit of a midfield debate. No Steven Gerrard nominated in there. Do you stick with Lampard as our midfielder to join De Bruyne and Patrick Vieira?
No, because I wanted to have Paul Scholes in there, but these two wanted Frank Lampard. The amount of people you speak to that played alongside these two at club level, at international level, played against both of them. Having seen Paul Scholes, he was a midfield genius. I loved him on the ball. Frank, I would say, had an unbelievable attacking prowess, the goals he scored at Chelsea. They both won numerous medals in the Premier League. I'm going to be a politician. I'm going to sit in the fence. I'm going to let one of the boys do it. But I just want to say Paul Scholes should be in.
All right, are we taking Lampard then? I think...
I'm going to be slightly biased. I mean, I play with him, I played against him a lot. And yeah, look, I just think you can't go without Frank Lampard. A midfielder who scores 177 goals in the Premier League is absolutely insane. Titles, dominance. Look, Paul Scholes, we could have an argument all day long. I think we could put five probably Premier League teams together. And and there's a valid argument to say Paul Scholes should be in as well. But I just think Frank Lampard.
All right. So let's go to the third of our strikers next to Shearer and Henry. We had a couple of nominations for Cristiano Ronaldo. Sergio Aguero's name was in there. Wayne Rooney was then discussed pre-show. Mark, we'll let you make the call on this because you kept goal against all of these players. Do you want Aguero or do you want Rooney or do you want Kron?
I think they're all valid. Again, the only thing I'd say about Cristiano Ronaldo is I think people are a little bit confused in that he's been one of the best players on the planet, 100%. I think he probably played 2 years. His last 2 years at Manchester United, he was up there with becoming one of the best players. I don't think he was the best player in the world. And I think he was great. I think he was really good. But even if you take Rooney and Aguero as the other two as an example, I think their stats speak for themselves. The longevity in the game, I think, it speaks volumes. Look, the stats of Rooney, 491 games and 208 goals. But Aguero's, for me, 275 games, he scored 184 goals. I think Aguero's right up there with...
When we talk about Premier League moments, 30 years of the Premier League, the goal that Aguero scored to win City the title and take it away from Manchester United, that will stick with me until the day I die, along with so many other Premier League fans that are not Manchester City fans. For that moment alone, and the stats you've just said, Wayne Rooney, Cristiano Ronaldo, get yourself on the bench. Let's get Aguero in, and also he deserves to be in there.
I must say, Rooney's overhead kick in the Derby game, it's another iconic moment. So he's also got one. But I think, Schwartzy, I think the stats, I think Aguero maybe just pips it as well. I think I'm on your team there, I think.
All right, we will go with Aguero. And if you disagree, there will be a graphic of this posted on Optus Sports socials. So jump into the comments and let us know who you are backing out of our experts, and also have your say on who you think should be in the team.
But I've got a hand grenade, right? So I did in the first initial vote say Peter Schmeichel, but I felt a little bit under pressure because everyone says Peter Schmeichel, right? And don't get me wrong, absolutely phenomenal. But again, I dig a little bit deeper and I look at stats quite a bit. I kind of didn't want to say it initially because everyone's going to go, oh, it's Chelsea again. But Petr Cech, Thomas and I spoke about this in depth before the show started. And I think I'm close to convincing him it's probably the right... He's right up there. His stats speak for themselves. His stats are actually better than Peter Schmeichel's.
You know, I have to take my Danish shirt off to be able to get on Schwartz's team here. But... you know, I think he's sort of gradually, with the conversation we had, he's gradually brought me over as well. I think, you know, the stats, I think Schmeichel was a transcendent player. I think what he did for United, the way he burst onto the scene, his demeanor, you know, his shouting, you know, how aggressive he was. He obviously used a lot of, you know, his technique was from his career or his early days in handball, you know, how he spread himself. So I think it was something that nobody had seen before. He was part of that Alex Ferguson era. But from a stat point of view, I have to say same amount of Cech has won more as well from a trophy point of view. So yeah, Peter Cech.
I am flabbergasted that you are going against your a man that you played alongside, a national treasure in Schmeichel.
Hey,
let's brainwash you and talk you into submission.
No. We have to take the emotions out of this. You know, I think from a stats and an all-round perspective, I think Peter Cech, and I think he doesn't get, because he just went about his business. He wasn't loud. He wasn't sort of controversial. I think people just sort of forget a little bit about him.
I also think we underestimate as well the ability to come back from the horrific injury he had to then become also still go back to those levels. Just those stats, right? So Schmeichel played 310 games, kept 128 clean sheets, which is fantastic. Won 5 Premier League titles. He's actually won one more Premier League title than Petr Cech. But Petr Cech played 443 and kept 202 clean sheets, which is the record in the Premier League for 4 Premier League titles. I agree. Schmeichel was, in terms of the image and everyone's first thoughts of Premier League goalkeepers, and the one that probably stood out the most was Peter Schmeichel and what he did at United and how he was and how, how big he was and how boisterous he was, and he made an impact. But I think when you talk about longevity and you talk about stats and success and took Chelsea to another level, I'm gonna say Petr Cech now.
Bridgie, I'll give you the casting vote. Schmeichel or Cech?
We've already had Lampard put in off the Chelsea team, and you know, Scholes has been demoted for that reason off the Manchester United bandwagon. When we brought our teams down. All three of us had Peter Schmeichel in there. He's won one more trophy. Peter Schmeichel is getting the nod for the Manchester United fans out there. There you go.
Thank you, Bridgie, for being the decider. Thank you for sticking with us if you have gone with us for about an hour and 10 today. We do appreciate your company. And just a reminder to all listeners that the Gegen Pod will be out each Wednesday during the season. La Liga and the Premier League are back this weekend. Espanyol versus Rayo Vallecano is at Saturday morning, 4 a.m. Eastern kickoff, followed by Sevilla against Real Valladolid at 6 a.m. And the Premier League kicks off with Tottenham against Wolverhampton Wanderers on Saturday night at 9:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. The FA Women's Super League is just a couple of weeks away. Of course, so many Matildas and England's Euros stars playing in that competition. All of this live and on demand on the Optus Sport app. On behalf of Michael Bridges, Thomas Sorensen and Mark Schwarzer, my name is Teo Pelizzeri. Thank you for listening to the Gegen Pod, the Optus Sport Football Podcast. Make sure you subscribe, rate us 5 stars, and we'll speak to you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.